Welcome to the That Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. We have an important show today. Our guest is Kari Lazar-White. Kari Lazar-White is a writer, social justice advocate, attorney, and activist who has dedicated his life to the educational outcome and opportunities for young people of color at key life stages. His support base is far-reaching and diverse, built over the 22 years as co-founder and executive director of the Brotherhood Sister Soul. Kari Lazar-White has a great deal of hope and optimism and cares about America and our future.
You know, I think we are existing in a time of deep conflicts and a time where the country is teetering. And I think that if we are not focused on caring about a broader circle than what we deem our own immediate community, our own constituency, then we will not be able to move forward a much more just and inclusive approach for the nation. I think it's essential that we care about one another in these times.
That, of course, is our guest today, Kari Lazar-White, who joins us to discuss his work helping young people throughout his organization, the Brotherhood Sister Soul, and his debut novel, Passage. Kari Lazar-White, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kari, I'll probably say this a few times during our interview, but your book, Passage, your first novel, is an important book, and we'll get into that. But the Passage is set in the early 1990s in New York City and tells the story of Warrior, a teenage boy who's being confronted with all the pressures that come from being a racial minority in the United States. Kari, where did Warrior and his story come from? And Warrior certainly is a unique name, at least to someone like me. Where did all that come from? Is that a part of you?
So Warrior is a character. There certainly are many elements of me in the lead character and a warrior in me. And yet, you know, the story is a novel. It is a piece of fiction and art, and so much of it is imagined as well. It is not in any way fully autobiographical, but certainly family and personal elements are woven deeply into the story. Warrior, as with many of the characters, is both real and in another way representational. He is part of the traditional hero journey. There's elements of myth and parable to the novel and to Warrior's journey. And so we want everyone to see in the character of Warrior hopefully some aspect of themselves, and yet also, you know, for it to illuminate an experience that may be foreign. It's set in 1993 because that is a time when I was roughly the age of the character. It's also a time of the greatest amount of violence here in New York City. And that ambient feeling, consistent feeling of violence that folks felt at that time, but also still feel today, I wanted to convey that. I wanted to convey that he came from a family of deep love and support, but yet every day he walked outside of his home and closed that front door, that the specter of violence was hanging there. And that's still a reality today. There was a lot of discussion with the publisher about whether we kept the kind of, you know, tent pole in the ground of 1993 and this announcement of a time. And we thought it was very powerful that it would reflect that time, but also many readers would feel that, unfortunately, much has not changed. And so, you know, that's why it was set in 93. And with regards to why his name is Warrior, that's what his name means in Akan. He's actually not yet ready to claim his name. He feels that that is something that he has to evolve to. And yet he also says at one point in the novel that he likes that every time somebody comes in contact with him and hears his name is Warrior, they know with what and with whom they are dealing. And there's a real power of names and lack of names, specifically in the African-American experience, of course, due to the institution of slavery in this country. African-Americans lost a connection to our names. And so if somebody is, you know, Italian or German or Irish, even if they don't speak the language of their home country, if they're an Italian-American, usually you can see in their name the connection to that country. Black people in this country lost the connection to the African names. Many of the last names were taken from those who had previously owned and enslaved them, or they were taken from presidents. And so you'll see a common usage of Jefferson and Washington for people's last names. But you also saw people take the very work that they did. And so common African-American names are Smith and Carpenter. You see colors and black and brown and white and green as last names for African Americans. And so part of it is also the loss of names. And so by not having names in the novel, I think it reflects that. And then it also reflects the internal journey of Warrior, so that his mother is his mother, his father is his father, his sister is his sister. When we come across those that we love, usually we see them in that connection. We don't think of their given or surname, but we just think of them in relation to us. And so it's very important to me to have this be a really internal journey, and that the reader would be brought into Warrior's experience and see the world through his eyes.
The other character that really jumps out at me too is the character of Brother Man, and he's so strong. He's giving advice to Warrior, and it's almost this kind of interesting balance. What's Brother Man's character about, and what's his value to the story?
It was very important to me in writing this novel to reflect the complexity and duality of characters, that Warrior can be from a family of such deep love and connection to his history and support by his mother and father, and yet face the violence and poor education and racism that he experiences when he leaves his door. And so in the character of Brother Man, in the same way, I wanted to convey somebody who in many ways is tough, not to be messed with, and yet very, very vulnerable. Somebody who is incarcerated and terrified, and yet also fighting back during his time being incarcerated. He is, again, a both very real and representational character. You know, we in this country incarcerate people in a way that no other, quote-unquote, developing country incarcerates people. We have nearly 2 million people incarcerated in cages across this country. And when you think about that reality and that people of good faith go to bed every night, and in your home city, in your hometown, there are so many people who are in jail who should not be in jail, either because they did not commit the crime or because we live in a society that penalizes people for things that other societies give help, mental health support, drug support, etc. for. He's representational of those who have been lost within our system. And somebody wrote to me and said, you know, I need to know what happens to Brother Man. You know, you have to write another book, or you have to tell me what happens to the character. And I said, well, that's the point, that we don't know what's going to happen to all these folks who are just held away from society in conditions that are horrific. Here in New York City, the second largest jail in America is Rikers Island, and it's been found by the U.S. attorney, or the former U.S. attorney before he was fired by Donald Trump, that torture exists on that island of 10,000 incarcerated people, including children, who are forced and tortured on the island. We allow that to happen. And so Brother Man reflects that. He reflects those who are incarcerated, those who have been quote-unquote lost, those whose voices have been silenced. And there's an interplay between him and Warrior where, you know, he on one hand is supportive of Warrior, but then Brother Man is also receives support and love from him. And I thought it was powerful to convey two young black men who have that kind of deep friendship and deep love.
The other interplay that I thought was really fascinating is this beauty and deep love between Warrior and his family, but particularly his father. You do this really nice job in the book of making the point that many young people have a father in their lives, and especially a father like Warrior's father, and that's important to you. Why is that so important to make that point?
I run an organization called Brotherhood Sister Soul, which is a social justice organization based in Harlem, and been doing that for over 20 years. And, you know, I've worked with so many young people who certainly come from families that have been destroyed or deeply affected by poverty and by drugs and by horrible personal decisions and also by societal conditions of poverty and economics and racism. But that's only part of the story. And I think all too often when we see media and we see television and movies and books that tell the story of the African American and the black family, it's one of degradation, it's one of destruction. And that is by no means the full story of our families and of our community. And I think it's important to show loving parents, both mother and father, involved in his life. There are so many men who take responsibility for their children, as they should, and raise their children. I don't think that story is told enough. And so while his parents are separated, they both deeply, deeply love their child. And I also thought it was important to show the sensitivity, the emotion, the love that Warrior has with his father, a black man to a black boy. something that has been central to my development and my deep relationship with my father and his involvement in my life, and a different idea and representation of what black manhood looks like. And so, you know, that was very important to me, to show that, to again show the sensitivity of it and the complexity of it.
Those are powerful female and male influences that I think my audience, certainly the audience of the 55 plus age community, are really going to identify. Passage isn't necessarily a young person novel. It's really for all ages. So for my audience, for this 55 plus age community who are watching the network news, they're seeing some of these images, you know, come to life in reality on, you know, on color TV every night. Why should they read this book and get a dose of reality from what is really a novel, a fiction book?
So this is definitely a novel that, to, you know, your question, is written for people of all ages. I definitely hope that young people, young black men, read it and see their experience in it. But as is the case in much fiction, you can have a young protagonist, but it not be a, quote, young adult book or a child's book, but instead be something that speaks to adults. I think all too often we don't listen to our young people enough. You think of the role of young people in the civil rights movement, in the movement for equity and equality for a gay and lesbian community, in the women's movement, you know, in the effort to bring down a president during the Vietnam War. You know, these are experiences that many of your viewers and listeners would connect to. It was their lived experience. And these were people in their 18, 19, 20, early 20 age range, mm-hmm. who were involved in these movements. Martin King was 25 when he led the Montgomery bus boycott. The Freedom Riders were in their late teens and they were in college. Universities were exploding with revolt against the administration. And so we've lost that. We've lost the connection to young voices, that somehow they're children's voices, as opposed to very powerful voices in their own right who need to be a part of the conversation. And so I think that part should speak to listeners and should speak to people of different ages. But I also think there has been a, you know, disconnect in this country since its founding, that somehow, you know, the experience of black people is an experience that is only of interest or connection to black people. Black history is American history. There is no American reality without the experience of black people in this country, due to economics, due to building the very White House and Capitol that the political quote-unquote leaders reside in, mm-hmm. currently. Mm-hmm. The entire system of economic development in this country was built off the backs of enslaved people. And so when you look at that, when you look at the very unique experience and connection of African Americans to culture and to jazz and to R&B and to soul music and now to hip-hop, when you think about the incredible contributions of black folk to the arts and the political space, you're not kind of peering into a black experience, you're peering into American history and an American reality. And so I think the story of Warrior, and as you know, he's visited by visions and his subconscious and his dreams that connect to times of slavery and segregation and, you know, colonial times in this country, that's something that everybody should be aware of. To be a fully informed American in this country, one needs to be connected to that very real history that helped to build this country and that still is a central role and aspect of this country. And so dealing with race and dealing with issues of you know, color in this country are not the province of black people any more than when you talk about sexism. Those are quote-unquote women's issues. The issue of how women are treated in this country and the continual sexism that women face and the explosion of sexual assault cases that we're seeing now, this again is not the province of women. Men have to be involved in this. Men have to be involved in this work. These are the issues that people of good faith and human folk should be involved in. And it's the same way with issues of race and racism in this country. We're not going to ever deal with that original sin until people of all faiths are involved in cleansing the country of that reality.
Carr, you mentioned your organization that you founded, Brotherhood Sister Soul, and I think we're actually talking today from your offices there. Many are involved in this excellent organization, people like Danny Glover, Harry Belafonte, an important inspiration to you, Soledad O'Brien, Rabbi Rachel Cohen's on the board of directors. It's an organization that is out very much outcomes based. I'll go back to kind of the very first question that I ask you during this period of when Warrior is active in the story about 20 years ago, and it very much parallels the founding of Brotherhood Sister Soul. Are you seeing enough change over that 20-year period between then and now for young people today to have hope and optimism and to strengthen their communities, or is Warrior still present today?
Without question, Warrior is present today. Without question, our young people continue to face gross economic inequality, lack of opportunity, poor schooling, over-policing, criminal justice system that seeks to engage them and bring them into the system as opposed to keep them out. I think the conditions, unfortunately, continue to be terrible that we allow too many of our young people to face. We look at what's going on the national level educationally, but also what's going on in so many of our states. New York City has one of the most segregated school systems in America. Those realities continue. They're kind of documented, objective facts. Does that mean that we have not made strides? Of course we have. And obviously we've made strides in terms of conversations around race and some levels of opportunity. But we live in one of the most, in a time now of incredible economic insecurity and inequality. And that has gotten worse over the last 20 years, not better. So when you look at the intersection of class and of race, I don't think that, unfortunately, our young people have more opportunity than they did 20 years ago. That doesn't mean that there's not optimism. I do believe that the country will change and that the opportunities for our young people will change over the long haul, because I think demographics speak to that. I think people of, you know, again, of good faith who believe in a more inclusive America, an America of more opportunity for all backgrounds, is growing. I think that movement is growing. I truly do believe that. But when you look at what children are continually facing in tough urban areas and even in many of our rural areas today, the lack of opportunity, the lack of ability to really compete in terms of employment, the explosion of incarceration of children and of people over the last 20 years, it's only increased. You know, when you look at those realities, when you look at the debt folks are saddled with when they try to go off to college, when you look at the income inequality and the lack of opportunities for jobs, unfortunately, that's, you know, what our young people who are coming from some of the most desperate, you know, conditions economically in the country continue to face. And so I think it's important that we name that, that we identify it, that we speak really clearly and openly to the class inequalities and racial inequalities that continue in the country. And then on the other hand, we continue to work in a broad tent and in a way people of all different backgrounds and faiths and experiences are holding hands and aggressively moving forward in a way that creates opportunities for all people. And I think this division that clearly the last election represented is an extremely dangerous one. And what we can't do is allow for the vicious voices of, you know, bigotry from Charlottesville, Virginia demonstrations to the language coming out of the White House and Donald Trump to silence what I think is the majority of the country that wants to pursue a different way.
Well, Kari, my final question for today, and literally I could talk to you for many, many more hours, but what advice, just kind of, you know, jumping from that last answer that you gave it, both as an organizer and as an activist, what advice would you offer my audience, again, those in the 55-plus age community, about giving back, about talking to their grandchildren and families, about being kind of boots on the ground organizing, becoming these artists and storytellers of these facts about the value of humanity?
I think first, everybody has to be involved and engaged. You know, I think that the inundation of negative news, the inundation of vicious, you know, vitriol that has dominated the political landscape and comes from the White House every single day, we have to push back on that every single day. And there are times where we can feel small and feel like, how is it that we can push back against, you know, such a large system? But I believe as an organizer, as a community activist for over 20 years, that the only way you push back is from the ground. And so first, everybody has to be engaged in whatever level they can be engaged. Some people will do it full time and with every waking hour. Some people will do it a few hours a week. But everybody who rejects where the country is now and sees the country going to a better place has to be engaged. I think the second thing is that people have to work across silos and outside of their community. People have to try to move and work with and form partnerships with people different than themselves, work across gender and sexual orientation, work across race and economics. It is not enough to just work in your own provincial space. And so I think that's the second thing that's extremely important. And then I think the third is to realize that this is a long haul, to realize that, you know, we are in a country that when it was founded on these ideals of freedom and democracy, that was only for, you know, land-owning white men. Women were not included. Native Americans were not included. Black people were not included. Many poor white men were not included. Women didn't receive the right to vote for, you know, nearly 100 years or 150 years after the founding. And so when you think about that, when you think about the fact that 13 generations of black people were born into slavery, 4 generations into segregation, and 2 generations born legally free, you realize how long this inequality has been in place. And so one can feel defeated at times if we do not understand how complex a situation we're pushing back against. And so I think really doing the necessary knowledge building, information gathering, learning, reading, researching to understand what we are seeking to overcome is also vitally important.
Kari Lazar-White, thanks so much for joining us today on the Not Old Better Show. Passage is an important book. My audience is going to gain much from reading it, as we've gained much in our conversation with you today, Kari. Sometimes these conversations about brutality, race, violence in our communities and fear, they can be difficult ones, especially when it comes to trauma to children. But you've made it so comfortable today. Civil discourse, I think, starts with civility.
Yeah, I agree.
The book is Passage. We'll have links to finding it on the website, and we are giving away a signed edition of Passage by Kari Lazar-White. Kari, thanks so much for being here on the show. Thanks for the signed edition. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me and for the rich conversation. I appreciate it very much.
My thanks to our guest today, Kari Lazar-White, whose new book, Passage, is available now. And we have a signed first edition from Kari to give away to the first person who contacts me. As usual, we'll post links to everything, including where to find me and this new book from Kari Lazar-White. And also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notold-better.com. That's info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better. The Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all, and happy holidays.